From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard, and joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. And here are the issues. President Trump fired the director of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, igniting a political firestorm. The firing came as the FBI was investigating a possible connection of Trump or his aides with Russians during last year's presidential campaign. In France, centrist Emmanuel Macron was elected president in a landslide over nationalist Marine Le Pen, further easing fears of populist gains in Europe. And Turkey warned President Trump that his decision to arm a Kurdish militia in Syria poses a threat to Turkish security. Well, in Washington, of course, we're overcome with another huge crisis provoked, really, by President Trump. What about it, David?
Well, as almost everything that happens in this town, it's like throwing a kind of rock into a mud pool. There are no kind of neat ripples. Basically, Democrats say that this is Watergate, this is Richard Nixon, this is a constitutional crisis. Republicans say the complete opposite. They say, no, Jim Comey, the head of the FBI, was doing a bad job, that nobody liked him, that the Democrats didn't like him. This is just a kind of left-wing hysteria. I think what we can say is what happens next really matters. So if Donald Trump now appoints a new FBI director who is a career FBI law enforcement guy who has worked with Democrats and Republicans, who has the trust of, you know, all sides, then actually this probably dies down. If he appoints someone who looks like a sycophant or a political loyalist or someone who is completely unqualified, then we do have a real crisis, because then that really would fuel the idea that he did this because the FBI was getting too close to his campaign in terms of the investigation with Russian meddling.
Let me read something to you that you don't have to respond to, but it may provoke something anyway. And this is from Matt Continetti, writing for the Washington Free Beacon, a very conservative website. And he says this: Trump doesn't face crises so much as manufacture them. In a way, he is the crisis, and his presidency is in danger of being defined not by any legislative or diplomatic achievement, but by his handling of the multiplying and daunting obstacles he creates for himself.
I mean, ever since the 21st of January, when he was inaugurated, he's obviously gone through a lot of problems with mostly Democrats, a lot of allegations, counter-allegations. And so far, none of those allegations have been settled in a clear-cut way. It seems to me that that's the style, that's the environment in which he likes to operate. So far, three major firings have happened under him. Mike Flynn, Yates from the Department of Justice, and now Comey. And obviously, I'm predicating everything I say about Comey on the fact that we have not heard anything from Comey yet about the details of what's happened. But when you talk to Donald Trump's supporters, core supporters, they obviously like it. They like the fact that, you know, whether you call it manufacturing crises or whether these are real crises, but the fact that he...
Well, I think they're real crises, whether they're manufactured by him or not.
And the fact that he turns around and he fires these people, I think that fires up his core supporters. And we've already heard many of them saying there's a Washington way of looking at things and there's an outside belt way of looking at things. Washington is talking to itself. These are manufactured crises, but in any event, our candidate, Donald Trump, is dealing with them the way that he promised us during the election that he would deal with them, which is basically to be an agent of change. That's rubbing a lot of Americans, obviously, the wrong way.
David? The Economist, I think you brought the editor of The Economist with you, and you interviewed many, many people in Washington recently, basically about Trump, and Trump as well. How did that go, your interview with Trump in particular?
So we interviewed President Trump last week for a big piece. We really wanted to ask him about how Trumponomics, you know, how his economic plan works. We also spoke to a lot of people in the White House, a lot of people on Capitol Hill. So it's not a tremendously reassuring experience asking him very straight, you know, we weren't trying to trap him, we weren't trying to trick him, we were asking him to explain, you know, he says that America has got bad trade deals with the rest of the world. We asked him to tell us what a good trade deal would look like. We asked him about how his tax plan would actually work in some detail.
What was a good trade deal?
So there's a really worrying sense that Donald Trump and the people who work for him really are pretty old-fashioned economic nationalists. And if you want to simplify, they basically think if America has a trade deal with, say, Mexico, if Mexico looks like it's getting anything from that trade deal, then America must be leaving something on the table. That if the other guy looks in any way happy, then America must be losing. And so they have a completely zero-sum view of these things, that, you know, they completely reject the idea that trade can actually be good for both sides, that it can be good for both countries. I think the simplest way to describe Donald Trump's worldview is, you know, that idea at the end of Second World War, that America was the most powerful country in the world, and that as that kind of global hegemon, it was probably a good idea for America to, you know, maybe be a bit more generous than other countries, maybe buy the consent of smaller countries to live in an American-run world. They completely reject that. It's a bit like listening to someone describing like an old gorilla in the forest who's maybe only got a few more years before he's taken down as the head of the kind of the group. And so the view is, you know, okay, we're going to get a few more years of hegemony out of this by being mean and selfish and biting people and making sure that people are frightened, because it's a hegemon in decline. But you buy yourself a few more years by being cynical and ruthless and zero-sum and aggressive and no longer letting others take advantage of America. That's the kind of mood around them.
Well, you certainly didn't sugarcoat it. No question about that. Abdi, where do you think this goes, this huge controversy provoked by Trump by firing the FBI director? And my view is that until there's some serious evidence that there has been collusion between Trump or his aides and the Russians in an effort to defeat Hillary Clinton last year in the presidential race, absent that this will probably die down over time unless Trump continues to make it worse for himself.
You know, that's also the sense that I have. I have a sense that Trump, using the style that he's used so far to deal with things, will waddle through until 2018. And I think unless there's a dramatic shift in the balance of power in Congress in 2018 in favor of the Democrats, mm-hmm. who would have the wherewithal then, who mm-hmm. may have the wherewithal to force something significant, whether you're talking about impeachment, there are already people talking about impeachment and so on, unless you get something like that, I see, obviously, Trump doing 4 years and maybe more than 4 years. Not that he'll be able to, even if the balance of power doesn't change in Congress significantly, not that he would be able to completely kill all these problems and leave them mm-hmm. by the wayside. But unless the Democrats do achieve something significant mm-hmm. in 2018, I see him, especially with the support of the core people who voted for him, I see him waddling along.
Well, there's certainly a possibility, a fairly real possibility, that Republicans would lose the House of Representatives in 2018. The Senate might be a little more difficult because there's so many Democrats whose seats are at risk. What's your take on that, David?
So I think what's really interesting is you can see two ways in which this could go badly wrong for Donald Trump. And I think that I agree with Abdurrahim and with you, Fred, that Democrats who think that this is going to be really neat and easy, this is basically going to be like Richard Nixon, but kind of sped up, mm-hmm. that, you know, he's going to prove that he's guilty, he's going to get caught, he's going to get impeached. Mm-hmm. I think they're being very optimistic. I think what's really interesting is if you spend a lot of time, as I know you both do, on Capitol Hill, and you talk to Republicans who have to try and get stuff done with him, particularly in the Senate, there's another thing that really worries them, which is that even if none of this leads to a kind of Nixon Watergate-style crisis, his administration risks becoming a failure simply because it lacks the discipline, it lacks the time, that he gets bogged down in these fights again and again and again. You start to talk to senators and say, you know, so are you going to get, you know, there are three or four big things they thought they were going to get done. They were going to rewrite the way that taxes are collected. Mm-hmm. They were going to slash back the rules that govern businesses. They were going to build lots of airports and bridges and railways mm-hmm. and infrastructure. There are now perfectly grown-up senators who think they might actually get nothing done. Mm-hmm. They might not get any of those things through because mm-hmm. this chaos that you talk about, this crisis mm-hmm. that he brings on himself, even if it doesn't lead to his impeachment, it could just lead to him being a complete and utter mm-hmm. failure as a president because mm-hmm. he's his own mm-hmm. worst enemy.
You know, I think President Trump is going to do better than that, than they think, but I know some Republicans fear that. And one of the things that would happen, you didn't say this explicitly, Abdi, but that if Democrats take over, say, the House of Representatives in the committees, Democrats would have subpoena power, which is a huge power to have if you're trying to dig into any subject. Then one subject would be Trump and the Russians.
True. But you know what? What should worry a lot of people, and I know it will worry a lot of people, if the case of impeachment or the case for impeachment is suddenly taken seriously beyond 2018 and it begins to produce some biting results in the political realities of this country, is how Trump's supporters would react to it. I cannot see Trump's supporters taking it lying down, either when it begins to look real or, and especially more dangerously, when it becomes a political reality. Then where does the country go? Just wanted to, if I may quickly circle back to Mexico, because it ties into this. Mexico sits right there. It shares, obviously, stating the bleeding obvious here, it shares a border with the United States. It shares a history with the United States, with the good and the bad and the ugly in that history. Mexico has always had chronic problems. And now you get the thing that David was talking about, which is that from the point of view of the administration, it basically, if the Mexicans get anything good, it means that the Trump administration have left something on the table, which they feel they shouldn't do. Mexico has always had problems. It's had even more chronic problems since it adopted the neoliberal level some 20, 30 years ago. If you go to Mexico now, this whole business of NAFTA, renegotiating NAFTA, but especially the business of the wall, has basically stirred the Mexican pot in a way that you don't know where the country would actually go. I think that the last thing that a lot of Americans would want to have on their border is a destabilized Mexico. And for now, it's stirring the populist trend in Mexico. But if, when push really comes to shove in Mexico, if things are derailed in Mexican politics, I cannot see how that would be in the benefit of the United States, either in terms of its economy or, more importantly, in terms of its security.
David, I'll let you say something about Mexico. But first, we have to take a break. As I remind listeners, this is Issues in the News, coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show today are Abdurrahim Fakara of Al Jazeera and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free downloads on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Don't you think, David, that Trump is backing away from what he talked about in his campaign about what he'd do with Mexico? He has not gotten any funding to build a wall. He backed away from repudiating NAFTA completely, and I don't think he can go back to that. But anyway, what about his backing away from that? Is that credible?
So you're right that where his promises on the campaign trail have collided with reality, he has had to moderate his promises. But Abdurrahim is also right that you have to worry about the effect this is having on other people's politics. And I think that this is actually a point you can make not just about Donald Trump in America, but about a lot of the nationalist, populist politicians you're seeing in places like Britain or in, you know, France. Or one of the problems with this new kind of nationalist kind of excitement is people forget that the other countries have politics too. So I know that advisors to Donald Trump, including people in his own White House, including senators, have said to him specifically, you risk creating a kind of a figure, a left-wing leader in Mexico like Hugo Chavez from Venezuela before. They look at South Korea and they hold their heads in their hands because Donald Trump tweeted out that the South Koreans should pay the bill for this new missile defense system that the Americans have installed against North Korean ballistic missiles, the THAAD, near Seoul. By doing that, they helped elect a left-wing, anti-American president in South Korea, who had explicitly criticized America and Donald Trump. You know, it makes it harder and harder. So even if you're right, Fred, that some of those kind of concrete promises to build a wall or to withdraw from NAFTA, they run into reality, and he actually is just left with kind of angry words and tweets. The problem is that in a world where other people have their own politics, those angry words and tweets actually have real-world effects. And that really worries the people around Donald Trump.
Did you want to add something, Abdi, or can I turn to France?
No, we can turn to France.
Okay, I want to read something by a colleague of mine, Christopher Caldwell, who wrote about the French election, and he said, French politics, which seemed to be undergoing a transformation congenial to populists and Democrats throughout the world, has in fact not been so transformed. This is the first sign that the Democratic tsunami that has been moving towards all Western elites since the Brexit vote last summer might pass some of them by.
Well, I would profoundly reject his sneaky linking of populism and democracy. The idea that it's a democratic wave to have Le Pen. No.
That's a larger theme.
No, but it's outrageous because he's trying to pretend this game that there's a liberal elite who hate democracy and then there's a kind of proud democratic kind of movement.
The Weekly Standard, David, is a conservative magazine.
Okay, but Christopher Caldwell, he's written a lot about France. I disagree with everything he's ever written about France.
Well, okay, how about this? Is the populist wave, whatever you want to call it, beginning to diminish?
So it lost, but we should still be very concerned that it got 33% of the vote. Marine Le Pen,
that was a landslide in favor of the centrist candidate.
So Marine Le Pen, the far-right extremist, racist, anti-Islamic, anti-immigration, populist demagogue with totally nonsensical economic policies, got 33% of the vote, which was double, more or less, the vote that her father, who is an even more extreme racist, got 15 years before. So the vote in 15 years has doubled, and that's pretty worrying. The other thing that's worrying is, of course, it's good news that Emmanuel Macron, this centrist, won the election, and as you say, won with 66%. Mm-hmm. But under the French system, to get anything done, he needs the French Parliament, the Assemblée Nationale, has to have a majority that will pass his laws. And there he has a real problem, because his movement is really a brand new party, and the two major parties which were utterly humiliated in this presidential election, the centre-right Républicain and the centre-left Socialist Party, which were totally wiped out and didn't have a candidate in this presidential election in the final round, they have not gone away. And particularly the centre-right, they are incredibly angry at the idea that this was essentially an election stolen from them. You had this. Remember that the outgoing French president, François Hollande, is a socialist who is unbelievably unpopular. At one point, his approval rating was 3%. That kind of puts him in the same range as Anthrax. So if you're on the centre-right, you basically think this election was yours by kind of due. It was your turn to provide the next president. Mm-hmm. Macron comes in, steals it from them, and so they have zero incentive now to help him in Parliament and in the elections coming up. We'll elect Parliament in a few weeks' time.
So the populist wave is not beginning to die out. Is that what you're saying?
No, it isn't, no.
Okay. Abdi?
The fact that Macron has won, it does not mean that Europe is home and dry. He has to go into alliances which will be incredibly difficult, not just to form, but also to govern through, particularly that the main historic parties in France have experienced a meltdown both on the right and on the left in this election. So that's number one. On the populism in Europe, when Wilders in Holland looked set to actually achieve victory in the Dutch election a few months ago, and that didn't happen, people in Europe sighed relief, but they were saying, wait, let's see what happens in France. With the result of this election, a lot of them sighed relief. But the problems that Macron was elected to deal with, they were not born yesterday, and they're not going to disappear tomorrow. Which means that the populists will be waiting in the wings. Now they do have the solid mass of strength, electoral strength. Remember that in 2002, Le Pen's father called on Chirac during the campaign to have a debate. And Chirac had absolutely no compunction about expressing his contempt even for the notion that he would appear with the leader of the National Front in a debate. Look where they are today. Mm-hmm. And I think their logic today is, okay, this guy has won landslide. Mm-hmm. Let's see what he can do. Whether he can pull it off or not in terms of governing and producing results, they will have a say in what he does in Congress. They will have representatives in the National Assembly, but they certainly have influence on the French street to transpose that concept from the Arab world to France.
Very good. Let's turn to the Kurds and the decision by Donald Trump to arm a Kurdish group in Syria that the Turkish president has differed from strongly and says it threatens Turkish security and that this is just a terrorist group and so on, or at least allied to a Kurdish terrorist group. And that sounded a little exaggerated to me, that fear.
So this is an example of Donald Trump looking at a sort of geopolitical puzzle that has sort of sat there like a kind of Rubik's Cube, kind of baffling experts for some time, because how did you cope with the fact that you need the Turks because that's where you get your point of access into Iraq? You know, there are big American air bases in Incirlik in Turkey. Mm-hmm. You need the Turks on side, but on the other hand, the most competent fighters who seem to be the keenest to take the fight to your enemies in places like Iraq are often Kurdish fighters, but the Turks dislike the Kurds and there are lots of different Kurds. And he basically took a baseball bat and just kind of smashed it down in that Rubik's Cube and said, yeah, you know, it doesn't look too complicated to me. These people are willing to kill my enemies. I'm going to give them some more weapons. So now we wait and see, does Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the strongman president of Turkey, does he react with kind of outrage and fury? Or actually, does he see a fellow kindred spirit in Donald Trump and say, okay, this is a guy I can do a deal. So if he's going to arm those Kurds, then maybe America will turn a blind eye if Turkey starts attacking a different group of Kurds who, the PKK, you know, separatist group who the Turks really regard as a threat to their own national security. America in the past has basically tried to keep the Turks from going after the Kurds too hard. So maybe you see some sort of strange alliance between these two strongmen, Donald Trump and Erdogan in Turkey, and you arm one group of Kurds and you let the Turks go after the other group of Kurds. You know, we could see that as a scenario. But there's basically a lot of kind of smashing of Rubik's Cubes going on at the moment.
Abdi?
I think the man to watch as far as this particular issue, for my money, the man to watch in D.C. now is not Donald Trump, but Sessions, the Justice Department. Because remember, for the Turks, the two main points of friction with the Obama administration were this issue of arming the Kurds. The other one was handing over Fethullah Gulen, whom Erdogan accuses of being behind the attempted coup.
Yeah, this is
last summer.
Exile who lives in,
Pennsylvania.
I think Philadelphia, yeah.
He lives in Pennsylvania. So if Sessions starts to make moves that seem to be pleasing to Erdogan, I think Erdogan will accept that he has to swallow this pill that Trump, in line of what Obama had done in the past, is moving to actually arm the Kurds. But there are practical benefits. There would be practical benefits for the United States from arming the Kurds, because the Kurds would give the United States long-term more influence in Syria, in line of the influence that the Kurds in northern Iraq gave the United States, beginning with the first Bush administration, but when Saddam invaded Kuwait in 1990. So I think there are practical benefits for the United States, but they will have to give Erdogan something. Erdogan is watching the situation, the ground shift under his feet, because why wouldn't the United States go with him, him being the leader of an important NATO ally? Well, we know Trump has reservations about NATO. NATO was very useful for the West as a whole, but for the United States, because it had an animus with Russia. That animus does not seem to exist so much in light of what Trump wants to do with Putin. And so all these things are percolating around Erdogan. But I would just circle back to my original point that for the United States to support the Kurd, seen through the prism of Trump, seen through the prism of Washington, has long-term strategic benefits for the United States in Syria.
Well, and maybe I can get a yes or no answer here, David. Was this really worth the risk for the United States to take this risk, backing the Kurds, arming the Kurds, and alienating Turkey, potentially?
Well, the problem is that if you want to find fighting troops on the ground who are going to take the fight to Islamic State, your enemy, and you don't want to send American troops, you need to find someone else. There's always been complications to choosing the Kurds, but the Kurds are willing to do it and no one else is, so you get stuck.
I'll leave it at that, and mainly because that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist magazine, and Abdurrahim Fukara, Washington Bureau Chief for Al Jazeera Satellite TV. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of The Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.